Fantastic having you along, and I trust that this evening will be a really encouraging time for all of us as we think about teenagers and all that entails. My name's Dan Begg, and I work here as a pastor of the church. So welcome tonight to this training teenagers seminar. Hopefully we'll learn something, and hopefully you're here to be encouraged and strengthened in being a parent. It's such an important role. Christine and I have four kids, so we know something about it. Now, our oldest one is 2 months off being a teenager, so we're here to take copious notes and learn. We've got Michael Knight here tonight, and welcome, Michael. Thank you so much for coming.
A couple of ideas, and hopefully get to some very good skills that you can use. But at any point, if you want to ask a question, or I don't make sense and you want some clarity, just interrupt, and that's quite okay. I have teenage children, and I work with teenagers all day. I am used to interruption. But I thought maybe to start with, it would be good to play a short little bit of Flickering Pixels. I stumbled across this video clip. For those of you who are YouTube addicts, you will want to go home and get a copy of this. It's simply called Everything is Amazing, but Nobody's Happy. And I think it sets up an interesting paradigm between a teenage generation that's coming through and those of us who are not teenagers anymore. Okay, you'll figure it out. And it's just a comedian who's being interviewed on a talk show.
When it was open for like 3 hours, the same line, write yourself a check like an idiot. And then when you ran out of money, you just go, well, I can't do any more things now.
Right.
I can't do any more
things. That's it, yeah.
That was it. And even if you had a credit card, the guy would go, ugh, and he'd bring out this whole chunk, and he'd write,
yeah.
He'd have to call the president to see if he had any money. And
it's all true, kids. You had to call the president, yeah. It was ridiculous.
Yes.
Do you feel that we now, in the 21st century, we take technology for granted?
Well, yeah, because now we live in an amazing, amazing world, and it's wasted on the crappiest generation of just spoiled idiots that don't care, because this is what people are like now. They got their phone, and they're like, ugh. It won't. Give it a second. It's going to space. Can you give it a second to get back from space? Is the speed of light true?
Yeah.
I was on an airplane, and there was internet, high speed internet on the airplane. That's
yes.
The newest thing that I know exists. And I'm sitting on the plane. They go, open up your laptop. You can go on the internet, and it's fast. And I'm watching YouTube clips. I'm in an airplane. And then it breaks down, and they apologize, the internet's not working. The guy next to me goes, this is bull. Like, how quickly the world owes him something
yes.
he knew existed only 10 seconds ago.
Right. Right.
And I'm playing. Flying is the worst one, because people come back from flights, and they tell you their story. And it's like a horror story. They act like their flight was like a cattle car in the 40s in Germany. That's how bad they make it sound.
Right.
They're like, it was the worst day of my life. First of all, we didn't board for 20 minutes. And then we get on the plane, and they made us sit there on the runway for 40 minutes. We had to sit there. Oh, really? What happened next? Did you fly through the air incredibly like a bird? Did you partake in the miracle of human flight, you non-contributing zero? That you got to fly? You're flying! It's amazing! Everybody on every plane should just constantly be going, oh my god! Wow!
Yeah!
You're flying! You're sitting in a chair in the sky.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
But it doesn't go back a lot. And it's not really. You know, here's the thing. People, like, they say there's delays on flights.
Yeah.
Delays, really? New York to California in 5 hours. That used to take 30 years to do that. And a bunch of you would die on the way there and have a baby. You'd be a whole different group of people by the time you got there. Now you watch a movie and you take a dump in your home.
Yeah. Nicer way to say it than that. But yeah,
not.
So there you go. So everything is amazing and nobody's happy. And if you get nothing else out of this evening, a great line is, you great big fat contributing zero. So if nothing else, you can say that to your teenager next time they're complaining, and they will just look at you. And when they're going, what's wrong with my phone? You can just say, it's going to space and back. You know, I do think that's a very clever sort of observation, but I just do need to know, how many of us ever had a rotary phone, you know, with the dial? Come on, be honest. Yeah. And how many of us hated people with zeros in there? Yeah. You know what I never got as a child, though, was in the event that an axe murderer was breaking into your house, Mum and Dad have decided to go out dancing for the evening. They've left me, my two older sisters at home, and we would need to phone the police. What was the number we had to dial? 000 on a rotary phone. Have you ever thought of how to try to do that silently and then control it on the way back? Because I'm going, there's an axe murderer running around my house, and I'm going, duh, duh, duh. By the you know, I'm dead. So anyway, forgive me, but these are the ways my brain works. So everything's amazing, nobody's happy. Listen, let me tell you a little bit about how I got here in terms of my professional journey. 26 years ago, I started off working with young people who were highly damaged, at-risk, wards of the state type people. The juvenile system in WA could allocate young people to prison, or they could allocate them to actually work in an organisation that I worked for back then called Youth for Christ. And we used to run a diversional therapy program, which is now referred to today, or adventure therapy. Back then it was just called camping. Anyway, and we would take young people out. They like to make really specky names for stuff these days. I've learned that about going to university. So we would take kids out into the wilderness experiences. Growing up in WA, we used to take, anybody here from WA? Nobody else escaped? Just me, okay, all right. But in the deep south of WA, we used to go to some pristine wilderness areas where there were no tracks, and it was amazing how you could really get through to people and change their perspective when you have them dangling from a rope over a 100-foot cliff, and they knew that you had a knife. Anyway, so we used to work in those situations, but over the years, I started to ponder to myself, are young people, in fact, lemmings? Are the adolescents that we work with have no greater brain power than a herd of lemmings, if the collective adjective for lemmings is a herd? Anyway, so I thought to myself, is it possible to get through to young people? Does every young person need to touch the wet paint sign to learn? Now, it is true, based on your psychoanalysis of personalities, that there is a percentage of the world who are clearly a touch-to-learn people group. The stove is hot, don't touch. Really? Oh, you're right. You know, some of us need to do that. Hands up, where are you in the room? Okay, thank you. Your church is in trouble that your leader is one of those. Okay, that explains so much about this evening. So that's one. But there are the rest of us who are the people who go, it's hot, don't touch. And then look at those of us who are running around with burn marks going, what is wrong with you? So I just wondered, are our young people in fact like lemmings? And so I postulated a theory. What if you could put a sign up on the edge of the cliff that said, danger, don't jump? What if maybe a couple of steps back from the cliff you could have another sign up? What if we could actually do that? One of the ways I experimented with this was in our organisation that I now work for, Peer Power. I got very sick and tired of a lot of sex education that gets foisted on young people in schools today in the name of education, when it's really an exposure process to indoctrinate minds to certain moral behaviours and codes. And I thought it lacked a degree of integrity in terms of just creating some neutrality. So what I decided to do was, rather than just complain, let's do something about it. So I produced an educational series for high school students on sex education that was very comprehensive, but the premise of it was that abstinence was actually the only form of safe sex until you're in a permanent, committed, lifelong relationship. But if you are going to get involved in sex, there are going to be consequences, and here's what they are. Produced this video and a manual. I went and found the largest educating distribution group in Australia, who are based in Victoria. and showed them the product and said, would you take it on? And they just sort of looked at me and said, you know, what idiot would put a sign up that says to teenagers, you know, don't do sex? And I'm going, well, my program doesn't say don't do sex. It says sex is best in a context. And if you take it out of that context, there is consequences. Anyway, the organization, which are not religious in any format, who basically operate on a capitalistic process of we sell things to make money, decided that it would at least look at my program. And the short of a long story was they took it on and started to sell it. And I can tell you now, it's been going for over 10 years. Remember, we just remade it the other day. And it's now it's gone from 5-part to an 8-part. It's on DVD and it's bigger than Ben-Hur. But when we remade it, I called up the company and I said, oh, you know, just thinking about doing a remake. Just want to know if this is worth my time, worth your time. Would you be interested? And they told me that our program, which at the start they laughed at me and said, as if teenagers want to know about that, became a national bestseller. Of their top 10 resources on sex education, numbers 2 through to 10 collectively have sold less than number 1. And the program we created is number 1. And so my premise, I think, has been found true. I believe it's possible to put signs up that if they are in the language that young people can understand, they are capable of responding. They may not volitionally want to respond, but they are capable of responding. So that led me to try to become more proactive with working with young people. And probably since about 92, I've now been working in high schools all around southeast Queensland and Sydney and Melbourne and places like that, but mostly southeast Queensland, running workshops of what we call life skills, where we are proactively trying to address issues that young people face and try to give them the skills to navigate through life without having to touch the hot plate sign. In the process of that, I decided to call myself rather creatively an adolescentologist. I did that because we live in a postmodern world, and apparently you can mutilate the English language these days and get away with it. My wife is one of those people who is very proper, which of course begs the question why she married me, but that's another issue. Anyway, she's a systems person. She believes in black and white and rules and right and wrong and all that sort of stuff. And so whenever I said the word adolescentologist, she would constantly balk going, it's not a word. I tried the argument of a word is made up of letters that makes a sound. So if you can say that, it's a word. She was unhappy with that as a definition and denied it altogether. I was on the internet one day. I was on OxfordDictionary.com. I discovered on the top left-hand side of the page, there was a little section that said new word entry. So I wrote in, adolescentologist, meaning one who studies adolescence. Ologist, adolescent. It was pretty self-explanatory. Submit. 2 weeks later, I get an email from Catherine Soames of OxfordDictionary.com. Dear Mr. Knight, thank you for your new word entry. We have now added that to our new word list. I print the email off. I gave it to my wife. Now, I'm not going to tell you because of proprietary reasons, but I'm not going to tell you what she said and where she told me to put that email. But I can tell you it has something to do with being very high in fibre. Anyway, So that's something of my little bit of a journey. So let me take you into this world of adolescent. How many of you have got adolescent children? Okay, I don't know if this video is prophetically true for you, if this describes the kind of conversations you have.
Hey, how have you been?
Good.
How's your dog?
Good.
How's college going?
Good.
All are you doing?
Yep.
You going out tonight?
Yep.
You gonna see your friends?
Yep.
You gonna have a good catch up?
Yep.
That should be great.
Yep.
Where'd you go?
Nowhere.
Who'd you see?
No one.
What'd you do?
Nothing.
Did you have a good time?
Yep.
What's on tonight?
Nothing.
You're not seeing your mates?
No.
You're just staying at home?
Yep.
What'll you do?
Nothing. Yep. Nothing. Sort of. Don't know. No.
Study?
No.
What's on
Many of you have seen that before, and many of you, it's very, very clever, I think, and somewhat pertinent. So let me now give you a little bit of a summary, if you will, on some observations that some people have made on adolescence. How many of you are familiar with Philip Adams? Okay, works on the ABC Nightlife. He said about adolescence that it's the brief period of optimism separating a brief period of ignorance from a terminal period of cynicism. Which I think says more about Philip Adams than it really does about adolescence. But I thought that was an interesting observation. Another gentleman by the name of Hugh Mackay, any of you familiar with Hugh at all? Okay, a few of you. He's written the book Advance Australia Where. He also has written another one called Reinventing Australia. He makes the observation, rather interestingly, of Australian adolescents that of course they feel insecure. Of course they have difficulty coping with momentous changes, which are of course occurring in their lives. Of course, adolescents are fearful of the future, and this is his sting, because they realise that the time has come to stand on their own two feet. And I think one of the great challenges of all of us parents is to never lose sight of our job is to raise a baby to being an autonomous adult whose job it is to leave home. Unless for some reason you are kind of very weird and you want your 40-year-old living at home with you all of the time, which is probably maybe very supportive and nurturing, but a little bit weird. Do you know what the average age now is of a teenager leaving home? Or a young person leaving home is probably a very more accurate word. 30, 25, it's 27. Every year post 21 costs you approximately $7,000 of your retirement income. Every year your kid stays home post 21. It's ching at $7,000 out of your retirement income, coming out of it. Per child. Get them out before 21. You make more money. So, you know, there's an interesting advertising campaign now about spend the inheritance, you know, like and all that sort of stuff about that sort of thing. So there's some very interesting shifts going on in our culture. And I'm not knocking children staying home longer. That's really totally unique to the family and the situation. My point is I want to say to you, as parents, let us never lose sight of what our major goal is. It's not to raise babies to stay babies. It's to raise babies to be adults. That's our job. That's what we're pushing them to be. At one point to be autonomous, independent, fine contributing members of society. That's where we're trying to get them. And let us never lose sight of that. So when we talk about this generation, the nuclear, Gen Y, Gen Z, Gen O, Gen Naughty, Gen all the different things that are going on at the moment with all this sort of stuff, I thought it'd be fun to give you a little bit of a test. And some of you may or may not be aware of this. So it's always fun to get you guys on the back foot straight away. So I'm going to give you three quotes. You've got to suggest when they were said. Quote number one, youth now love luxury, they have bad manners and contempt for authority. Quote two, I see no hope for the future of our people if they are dependent on the frivolous youth of today. Quote three, the young people of today think of nothing but themselves. These could have been tonight's headlines. Any guesses? Yep. Roman times? Yep, for one of them. Others? You know, you'd actually like, you know, if you get it wrong, it's not like MasterChef, you're going to go home tonight. You know, you're actually allowed to interact here with it. Okay, well, number one was actually said by Socrates. Okay? In 399 BC. The second one was by Hesiod. 800 BC. And then the last one is contemporary. It's only 1083 AD. Okay, there's a point to this though, isn't there? Does it really change? You know, we really all go through the process, and part of that is because, again, one of the stages of adolescence is what? When you're a little child, your job is you're totally focused on your primary caregiver. When you move from little child into that primary school years, you shift your focus to your secondary caregiver. And whether that's a nuclear family, broken family, blended family, dysfunctional family, whatever it is, psychologists map this, it always seems to be the way. The child under the age of 3 is focused on primary caregiver. Dad's home, it's dad. If mum's the one that's at home, it's mum. If the daycare person is the one that's looking after him, it's the daycare person. Who is the predominant person in their world is their primary caregiver. Who spends the most amount of time with them? If it's grandma, grandma's going to be the primary caregiver. Secondary caregiver is obviously the other half of that situation. But when they move into the teen years, when we talk about that horrible sentence, peer pressure, what's actually going on is the adolescents, by that 12 age, have basically been imprinted by your values. And now, just like you did, they're testing out your values. Just like you tested out your parents' values and think they never knew. And now karma is coming back to bite you, and I don't believe in karma, but now you're having to relive this experience and you are now the parent. And it's so much fun when you can bust your kids and they look at you going, how do you know? It's like, because I didn't come down in the last shower of rain. You know, like, I do like that about children. So the teenage window, in psychological speak, is the time when the adolescent is trying to figure out, is what mum or dad, say is true? That's what they're trying to do. That's why, have you ever noticed, if you watch adolescents en masse, and I do a lot of this in my day-to-day job, when, if I was working with a room full of teenagers today, at some point in the seminar, one student will make a smart aleck comment to another. What do you think their immediate subtle body language is at the moment they make the comment? What do they do? Have a guess. Sorry? No, I don't think it's almost immediate. It's not it's not how do I react to their comment. It's the moment they make the smart comment, what do they do? They look at their friends. Now, they're looking at their friends because they're testing mum and dad's values. They're trying to work out what values do they want to own. But most importantly, the way they're testing it is they're putting it out onto the altar of their peers. And they're asking the question of their peers, is this a good idea or not? Because now they're looking towards their peers going, do they affirm this? Okay, so being a smart ass was a good idea. Or do they frown on it? Okay, bad idea. So that's what that peer window is all going on. So never lose sight of that as you work through that. Any ideas who this guy is? This is an animation of a real person. Freud? No.
It's not Dan.
It's not Dan. No. Dan, when you had the fringe, I know the feeling. I got, it's okay, brother. Everyone gets the same amount of hormones. People want to allocate theirs to growing hair, go right ahead. So, and you have to figure that joke out, and if you can't, that's all right. How many kids have you got, Dan?
Four.
I got 3. Work out the numbers, people. Okay, all right. So, now, anybody know this guy? Let me give you a clue. Okay, that's his name. Thank you very much. This is what he drew, and this is what he said about the show. Okay, he talks about nihilism, which is the sense of despair. And the show is talking about the fact that life is empty in the end. The point is to try to teach people how to have fun in the midst of it. And we, I think, are living in a generation and a shift in culture where our current generation are no different to that opening video of the teenager who lives in a world that has the technology of a mobile phone where they can do their Facebooking and spacing and all that stuff on their mobile phone in the instantaneous now. And the only things that matter is what's going on now. And there is no real sense about tomorrow. My 18-year-old last week, just to give you an idea why you don't want me to be doing your parenting workshop, as in like marriage, my 18-year-old last week is at university, burst into tears on me last week. For no apparent reason, I didn't do anything. I just walked in the room. So I'm like, what's wrong? I was trying to be caring and sympathetic. She, amongst her tears, gets out the fact that next week she had a major assignment due. I, being the caring dad, then said to her, "Oh, really? Okay, well, when did you find out about this major assignment?" "Well, we got it at the start of semester." And I went, "Okay, what week are we in now?" She said, 9. I said, "So it's due in 10. She said, "Yes." And I said, "And how much have you done on it so far?" "Nothing." And so which I responded, "You know, the good thing about failing a university course is it actually teaches you that you have to pay hex twice. And therefore remind you, maybe you should start studying a little bit earlier. I see a lot of upsides to this current experience you're in." She burst into even more tears and ran to her mother, who was standing right next to her at the time and was giving me a look that sort of suggested that I was right off track. Needless to say, I'm happy to tell you that tonight, she said to me, she has it in a final draft format. It's due on Friday and it looks like she's going to get it in. It's amazing what pressure can do to people in times. But you know, one of the interesting things is that we are dealing with a generation of young people who live in this instantaneous now, who just want this kind of demand dynamic. They just want what they can get. They, you know, it's about me, it's about now, and it's about subject to a better offer. So I'm totally committed to doing my assignment, subject to getting a better offer, which could be Facebook. Ironically, last night, my house is called a two-story house, and she was downstairs working away on her assignment. I was sitting upstairs watching MasterChef with the rest of my family. At one point, Taylor yells out from upstairs, "Oh, tell me when you're going to start watching Facebook so I can come up and join you." Long silence. Thank you for picking it up. I then went, chuckling to myself, I went, "Sorry?" And she went, "Tell me when MasterChef is on." And I said, "Are you currently on... Shut up, Dad. Just leave me alone." Okay, just curious. I so enjoyed that. Possibly one of my favourite authors is a gentleman by the name of Ravi Zacharias. He's an Indian-born but American resident. Probably, I think, one of the world's leading thinkers. He has a website called rzim.org, short for Ravi Zacharias International Ministries. He's a Christian thinker and like no other that I know of. And his sort of catch line is, "Let my people think." That's the way he sort of operates. He makes the observation of youth today by saying that they hear with their eyes and they think with their feelings. Now I have a question for you. You're being very passive. I want you for a moment to turn to each other and I want you to chat for a sec and try to see if you could explain or illustrate what does it mean when a young person hears with their eyes. Can you give me a context or an illustration of how that would actually be manifest? Or think with their feelings. So have a chat, conversation time, give you about a minute, then we're going to get some responses. Sounds like you people actually got some stuff going on there. illustrate. Somebody give me an illustration. What does it mean to hear with your eyes? What do you think that could be?
It could be all the text messages.
Yeah.
The Facebook stuff that they're doing.
Yep.
Conversations with their eyes.
Yep. I think that's very much a part of it. Yep, I agree. Anybody else?
What about your example of the reaction to the smarter comments, like they look around for...
Yep. Yes, yeah, the way they pick up on visual cues. Yep. Absolutely. They're always doing that, almost on a voyeuristic level. They pick up on the body language, yep. Ah, yes. That's a really critical insight. Thank you. I think that's a magnificent point. They're very astute to watching what we do, much more than what we say. Can anybody else? What else do you think this could be? When a young person's asked, when you ask of a young person, how do you know that's true? What's their sourcing that they're going to give you? What it feels is that that's the second point there, isn't it? It's just that it's my feeling. Why do they engage in some of the sexual behaviour or the drug taking or the riskiness? It felt right. There's no objective sense of truth. Anything else? Yep. Yep. So that's definitely one interesting frame. Yeah. Unless they see it, they don't believe it. Absolutely, very much so. Very much so, especially the males. We know that through MRIs now and brain scans that have been done. Matter of fact, if any of you got teenage boys, okay, if you have got a teenage boy, there is hope. Okay, I just want to say that. Two books, two outstanding resources that you really should have. Number one, He'll Be Okay, H-E-L-L, short for He Will. He'll Be Okay, author is Celia Lashley. L-A-S-H-L-I-E. She's a New Zealander. She was the first female prison guard in a maximum security Maori prison. Why she wanted to be that is a whole nother conversation. However, she was, and she's written this book called Raising Gorgeous Boys into Fine Men. And it is a magnificent book, and she is a mother of a boy who's now 25 or 30. Absolutely brilliant, brilliant insight on raising boys. So highly recommend that one. He'll Be Okay. Second book, The Minds, M-I-N-D-S, The Minds of Boys. The author is Michael Gurian, spelled G-U-R-I-A-N, I think. But if you just type in The Minds of Boys, this book is probably the most up-to-date research from a neurological perspective on the physical brain of boys. And basically he talks about, he's a neural doctor. He has basically done the research on, they did, I think it was 1,000 boys had MRIs done on their brain over a number of years to basically see if they could get pictures of the changes in the development of the physical brain over through those adolescent years. And it is now what they refer to as hard science. So if you think of psychology as we think this is what's going on, if you go into medical science of we know this about the human body, The Minds of Boys is about the hard science of physical development of male brains. In a nutshell, girls are about 3 years in front of boys during all that adolescent window. Matter of fact, girls start off with 25% larger corpus callosum, which is basically your hard wiring between both sides of your brain. So every woman in this room, when you start off in life, you've basically got the new part of the Southeast Freeway about where you hit Bean Lee, where it goes to 8 lanes, right? You've got an 8-lane superhighway running both sides of your brain. boys have got the Gap Creek Road. It's not even sealed yet. Okay, it's the best way to understand the difference. The good news, though, is boys have got a really big capital investment fund, and later in life, they can put in more lanes if they develop them. Boys can often choose not to. That's why when you ask in a room, hey, give me a response to this, women will answer like that, and guys will answer, thank you that the wife's here because she'll answer for me. Okay, and that's what goes on. And there's a neural difference. So Girion talks a lot about this, and it's very interesting. His best illustration that he gives, I think is profound, is for those of you who've got girls, I have two girls and then a boy, I would never put any of my daughters in a rugby team that was playing in an all-boys rugby system. Now, forget gender politics for a second. Just think physiologically. Why wouldn't you do it? Well, that's the thinking speed, but just think physicality for a second. She hasn't got the strength or the size. On average, the male body is about 20% larger than, on average, the female physique. Why would you put a small person in the front row? You wouldn't. You put the big guys in the front row. Why wouldn't you put a girl in a rugby team? Now, it's not saying you can't do that. I'm just talking about this as a metaphor. And then he says, if we don't do that to girls in the physical sporting sense, why do we put boys at the same level of girls chronologically but expect them to perform just like girls do with that ability, who are carrying 25% more connections in their brain? It's a brilliant insight, isn't it? The minds of boys. If you don't have it, you're a parent of a boy, you need to get it, you need to read it. It's not a scientific book. It's very well written. It's very easy to read. And the best part is, it's just the hard science that we now know. And best of all, he's got pictures in there, so it's visual, you can see it. And there's a lot of practical tips, and there's a lot of questions that they ask. And I work with a lot with teachers, and I'm arguing this all the time. Matter of fact, if I could construct education, I would put boys 2 years behind in the schooling. So put, 15-year-old boys in the room with 13-year-old girls, and you basically got a degree of equalness. Because even a 13-year-old girl can shut down a 15-year-old boy with a look. So it's not like the girls are going to get intimidated, But in terms of, now that won't happen in terms of education. But in terms of reality and pragmatics, you've got to understand that. That's a big, big difference. So they do hear and see and think and feel differently in that sense. The other thing about it, at a very superficial level, is because they saw it on the internet, it's true. It's interesting how they all know 3D is not real, but because it's there, it's true. I read it on the internet. It is fascinating me now that universities estimate that 85% of all university students plagiarise. Bond University, I know someone who's a lecturer there, has some of the most sophisticated software in the world that every assignment is lodged electronically and it's scanned down to, I think it's 3 or 4 word grabs against the entire internet. And they monitor it to basically work out how much you've plagiarised. And then the onus is on you to demonstrate that you didn't. And it's such a fascinating world because we've created quite a postmodern environment with that. All right, let's move on. Another book I want to recommend. Please.
Apropos of the girls, the boys, the 13-year-olds, the 15-year-olds, do you feel that faith-based schools operate better than the school?
Great question. I work in some of the top private girls' schools in Queensland. I work in some of the top elite boys' schools in Queensland. I've also worked in some very poor boys' schools and some very impoverished girls' schools. And I work in co-ed schools right across the food chain. Okay, so I've worked in the 300-plus high schools in Queensland. I've been in about 190 of them. Okay, so from a personal observation, but also from the research that I've found. One, in the last 100 years in America, I think something like 2 new boys' schools have opened up, whereas hundreds of girls' schools have opened up. There is clear evidence to demonstrate that girls in a single-sex school will outperform girls in a co-ed environment. That's pretty unequivocal now. No, there's no dispute about that. However, the real essence of what's going on is if you look at adolescence from primary school through to the end of high school, if you look at all that 12 years of schooling, America still has junior, as you're looking, junior, mid, senior. So you've got the three schools. A lot of schools in Australia are now moving towards middle schooling. Okay, if you look at this, the evidence is pretty universal now that where single sex works at its best is co-ed up to the end of junior school. Co-ed through middle school, but with single sex classes. So at morning tea and lunch, they interact. But during class time, you divide. Then in senior school, go back to co-ed classes. Now the research globally in Western countries, America, England, New Zealand, Australia, places like that, the universal outcome that seems to come out is that trend. So co-ed them all the way up to basically puberty. During the puberty years, so 11 through to 14 or so like that, put them in a co-ed environment, but give them single-sex classes. And then, in high school, the rest of the high school, go back to co-ed. So that's what the evidence is really pointing towards. There are a lot of boys' schools that will argue that boys do perform better in a single-sex environment. And yes, there's a lot of evidence to demonstrate there's a lot of benefits for it. But I would say the most noticeable hindrance is guys in that environment learning the social skilling of how to treat girls. Not saying, by the way, just because they're in a co-ed environment, they get a better deal on that. I think the whole issue of pornography is insidious and epidemic and highly problematic. And I'm not saying that from a moral perspective or a religious perspective. It's just a factual perspective. So if you can construct it best, go to a co-ed environment that has single-sex classes during the puberty years. Joanne Deak, who wrote the book Girls Will Be Girls, who's a Canadian psychologist, she's a passionate advocate for female girls' schools, will also point to this fact. Girion, who wrote The Mind of Boys, will point to this fact, and there's plenty of evidence out there to support that. So that's really the nutshell answer for it. Girls in girls' schools will enjoy the advantages of not being perturbed by the boys there and then, but they think about them all the time, and they're probably texting them during the day and all that goes on with that, and vice versa with guys and girls. So, thank you. Good question. Next thing I want to talk about is a little bit about this digital stuff for a moment. So let's get into this. I stumbled on this book called Born Digital. It's written by two professors of law who go to a questionable university. You may not think it's very authoritative. It's called Harvard. And I thought it would be interesting to read what two Harvard law professors had to say about the sociology of a digital generation. In a nutshell, if you don't get this, okay, there are those of us who are born digital, okay, not my generation, but basically everybody probably post about, 1980-ish, growing up in a world of never not knowing computers. Okay, then there are those of us on the other end of the spectrum who are digital immigrants. Okay, we rely on our adolescent child going, you do my website and I'll do your homework. Or if you don't like the patriarchy of that and you would like a little bit of a feminine touch, here's the female side. I think this is quite cute. If you can't read it, no, you weren't downloaded, you were born. And only a mother can say that with a great deal of passion and focus. But it's interesting, you may have heard of this gentleman here, Rupert Murdoch, who's possibly the world's largest media baron, says, if you can't read it, like many of you in this room, I am a digital immigrant. My two young daughters, on the other hand, will be digital natives. They will never know a world without, broadband internet access. We may never become true digital natives, but we can and must begin to assimilate into their culture and way of thinking. Now, I'm not so sure about the last part of Rupert's comment, but the first part I do want to agree with very strongly, and that is that there is a very clear distinction probably one of the greatest social shifts is the digital world. Go back to that opening video. You know, it's like, what's wrong with this thing? You know, my friend the other day, who's 10 years older than me, he's 56, showed me, he said, look, Michael, I got this new phone. And it was a slide one, and it was from Nokia. And he said, I can't believe I got it for $50. I said, it's fantastic. He said, yeah, he said, the girl in the shop just couldn't believe I wanted to buy it. And because I said, well, what's wrong with it? And she said, well, it's just a basic phone. And he said, what do you mean by that? And she said, well, you can make phone calls on it and send text. And he went, that's what I want. And she goes, but you can't surf the internet. I don't surf the internet. He claims to be a technological dinosaur. And he goes, yeah, I'm T-Rex. You know, it's like he just, and she was like going, but you can't, and he was, and then she says, but it's not a very good camera. He's going, it's a phone. I just want to make a, can I make a phone call on it? Yes. But, you know, she was going, but you could get all of this other stuff. And she was going, I don't want this other stuff. I want a mobile phone. You know, like, I don't want a mobile office. So he couldn't win that argument. But, you know, there's the digital immigrants, those of us who have been dragged into this. There is a third group. And in the book Born Digital, he suggests a third generation, which he calls the digital settlers. And that's for those of us in the room here who have become quite competent at the digital world. It's not natural to us, but we have definitely mastered some skills in that area. And that's probably a very good thing. Any ideas what this is? It's a personal computer designed by the RAND Corporation. And best of all, they did this in 1954. I particularly like the steering wheel. I really want one of those. You know, I've got to tell you something. For those of you who, I was in China 2-3 weeks ago. I was in a shopping centre and I saw in the digital section an old style phone. Do you remember the really old ones that had a large base, a tall stem with a microphone bit and then a handpiece that you actually pulled off and put to your head? Remember those things? There's replicas of them. And so I thought if you could buy it in China, you'll definitely be able to buy it on eBay. It arrived yesterday in my house. And it's a complete cast iron replica phone, other than it's not rotary, it's push button, but it looks like a rotary. It's a fully working phone. It's absolutely fantastic. I love it. My teenage daughter just looked at it going, what the hell is that? And I went, it's a phone. And she was just, no. Digital native, digital immigrant, digital settlers. You know, what is interesting was, this was the computer they estimated in 1954 that the computers in 2004 would look like. That was their guess on what a 2004 computer would look like. I searched the internet to find for you a picture of a computer that was produced in 2004. It looks like that. And of course now, it looks like that, doesn't it? The iPad. Any of you signed up for one yet? Any of you going to sign up for one of them yet? While I'm sitting in China, I was in Beijing in the hotel. My colleague who was from America had an iPad that uses Wi-Fi. If you don't know what that is, neither do I. Okay, now, apparently it's some way to talk to aliens, I think. So he sets his iPad up, which is no bigger than, I'm just scared to move this computer too much, it is no bigger than the thickness of this screen, and it's about the size of this. And that's the whole computer. So I've got this base chunky bit. The iPad is just the screen. That's all it is. And he streamed live Major League Baseball. And we were sitting there watching in high definition on a 10-inch screen Major League Baseball being streamed live from America wirelessly on the table. And it was just... And the resolution was unbelievable. I mean, it was almost overpowering. It was so strong. Now, we've got to understand this. I want to spend a few moments here talking for this for a second. One of the interesting things, I found this graphic on the internet and thought it was really pertinent. It reflects a lot of my personal values. Now, this is a bit hard to read, but it says, this is the last page of the internet. Stop browsing. Turn off your computer. Go outside and play. Now, that's probably a reflection, again, of the digital native who doesn't understand the digital immigrant who doesn't understand the native, who wants to stay there. But one of the interesting comments that was made about the internet was that it was said, and this was by an 18-year-old Harvard student, that the internet has no beginning and no end. And that's what draws them into it so much. Well, at the risk of being a little bit rude, I want to introduce you to this gentleman here, J.C.R. Licklider of MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He actually is the first guy to invent the internet, and I just want to point out a couple of things that were rather interesting about this, in that, and I've just got my notes here, so just take me for a second. He said the idea of, he proposed the idea of a first global network of computers in 1962. Lawrence Roberts of MIT connected a computer in Massachusetts with a computer in California in 1965 using telephone lines. The first effort to index the internet was created in 1989, and in 1991, the first really friendly interface to the internet was developed by the Uni of Minnesota. Microsoft completed the shift to a commercially based internet with the release of Windows 98 in June of 1998. Very good. So it's interesting that there are people who are 18 years of age going, the internet has no beginning and it has no end. Well, it did actually have a beginning, and it was in our lifetime. And there's probability that it might have an end, because if Tony Abbott gets his way, there will be no more high-speed internet in Australia. But that has nothing to do with any of that. So let me now take you to this. I need to back up one story before I get to that picture. I do want to point out to you, do you know that every day your young person who lives in a city like Brisbane, a major capital city, will be exposed to 3,500 to 5,000 data bursts of information every single day? Let me add to that. The web has roughly 8 billion websites currently, 105 million blogs with 120,000 new ones are added daily. 161 billion gigabytes of digital content was created in 2007 alone. That is 3 million times the amount of all the information in every book ever written. Let me repeat that. There's 161 billion gigabytes of information was created and stored in 2007, digitally. That's 3 million times the amount of every information in written books ever written. Okay? If you converted that into a pile of books, you would stack 12 stacks of books, there'll be 12 stacks of books that would reach from the earth to the sun. That's what we're talking about in volumes of information. So our young people are living in a world where they are exposed to vast, voluminous amounts of information. Does anybody know what this picture is? Anybody? Yep, go on, tell me. It is the barrier gates of the Thames River. What does the barrier do? In case it ever floods, as a proactive measure, they built these floodgates on the Thames, and they can shut the Thames River off at the mouth so that the water cannot flood in and flood the Greater London area. Now, that is a wonderful idea to try to minimise a voluminous amount of flood coming through. The question is, how do our young people cut out 3,500 to 5,000 data bursts of information every single day? And the answer is, they have an inbuilt bovine feces meter. Okay, being in a Presbyterian church, I hope you appreciate how sensitively I said all that. Okay, so, now, in other words, young people today, I think, have got an intuitive level of going, you're trying to con me, or this is for real. It goes back to that hear with their eyes comment. And they are very good at this, which therefore points out the point, they watch what we do, not so much what we say. Time is running away from us, so let me jump to... Now, what time have I got to be done?
You've got
20 minutes. 20 minutes, okay. Couple of scary and interesting thoughts about the volumes of information. Anybody have any idea who this lady is? Because she's famous. Now, I'm almost... guaranteed nobody will know her, but she is famous. Any guesses? Okay, her name is Brianna Lahara. Fill in any blanks? No, not Ugly Betty, but probably has similarities. She lives in New York. Her claim to fame is she is the first person in American history to be sued by the American Record Industries Collective for
downloading music.
Little Brianna had downloaded about 1,000 songs on her computer through things like LimeWire and all that sort of stuff. The companies, within 3 months of LimeWire opening, now if you don't know what LimeWire is, a software that you can download for free that enables you to access music files on other people's computers and copy them. In my day that was called stealing, in this day it's called sharing. And the major record companies of America, in 3 months, their record sales dropped by a third. Therefore, they went after LimeWire, they went after Napster, and they shut them down. On a technicality, within 1 week, both of them opened up version 2. They were unable to shut it down. So the companies decided, we can't go after the software merchants, let's actually go after the end user. Now, there's an interesting dilemma here. This is a capitalist system. In other words, record companies want to sell records and have people buy them. It's a bit strange to sue the people who buys your record. But that's exactly what they did. And they got hold of Brianna and they sued her. Now, here's what it's worth. She had 1,000 songs on a computer. The fine was $150,000 per song. Do you reckon she got Mum and Dad's attention? The total fine that the judge could have awarded was $150 million. $150 million was the fine. But the court company settled with Brianna for $2,000. Now, for those of you that aren't capitalists, why would you, when you've got a lay-down mazare, open-and-shut case, where you could make big bucks, settle for $2,000? Why did the record companies do this? It did set a legal precedent. That's absolutely what it did. Sorry? Absolutely. It got everybody's attention. It absolutely did that.
You don't want to get negative publicity as well.
They didn't want all the negative publicity. But you know what they did do at the end of this court case? They publicly declared, we want you to know. We know who you are. And we know that you've downloaded our songs and we are coming after you. And then they lined up their ducks, and one by one, they started contacting the N-line users. And they settled for $2,000 every single time. Because they weren't really after the money. But here's the really interesting sub-theme. When the average young person's on their computer, and they are just downloading stuff, the average person thinks to themselves, no one will ever know. And the record companies didn't care about the money, but they actually taught the world an interesting lesson. And we've got some IT people in the room who can talk about this far more intelligently than I ever can. But they can track it down. I'm going to a conference in a couple of weeks on internet cybercrime and pedophilia and all this sort of stuff. And this guy used to work for the federal police, and basically within about half an hour through the numbers on the computer? Yeah, the IP address. They're basically able to track down within 30 minutes who you are and where you live. And the record companies found this girl. You know, it's pretty scary what they're able to do. So what's the point of this story is simply to say we're dealing with a generation that are overloaded with data, but we're also dealing with a generation who think to themselves, nobody knows. Now, by the way, this information I got from the book Born Digital. The reason you want to buy that book is there are a couple of chapters in there on identity and on identity theft and on privacy that when you've read, you're just going to put it in front of your teenager and say, You just need to read this. I'm not trying to convince you. I'm not trying to prove a point. I just want you to know what you think you're doing alone in your computer and nobody knows. You're actually publicising it globally. That's what you're actually doing. It's not private information. It's public domain. I recently was told... Sorry, can I?
I was going to ask, will that encourage
them to get off Facebook? Well, I only discovered this the other day, that when you put your photo up on Facebook, Facebook now owns the copyright on it. So when it encourages you to put all your family photos up, you're giving your family photos to Facebook. Yeah. Well, here's an interesting thing on Facebook. Let me point out to you that there is currently 67 million active users on Facebook, 250,000 new registrations per day since 2007. What's interesting about that fact is not that fact alone, but during the same period of time, Americans who have been surveyed identify that they have one-third fewer friends. The primary trigger on Facebook that I've been able to figure out from my research on it is how many friends you have identified next to your name. And while we're getting large numbers virtually, we're also declaring we have less people who actually are our real friends. Matter of fact, the survey went on to say that those who classified themselves as having no friends had more than doubled. So although we've got this increasing use of social networking sites as a mechanism to befriend people, what we're actually discovering is they're actually, and my suggestion is, I think what social networking is doing is it's giving you the ability to develop bad habits without realising it on how not to communicate, while never enabling you to develop good habits on how to communicate. See, once upon a time, we're actually in the process of developing a brand new seminar at the moment called 3D relationships. I don't think it'll ever take off, but the idea behind it is this. It's actually teaching people to go up to a complete stranger and go, "G'day, my name's Michael."
"G'day, I'm David."
David, lovely to meet you, David. So what do you do normally during the day?
I fix computers.
Fantastic, mate. Well, I work in schools. Now, this is actually called 3D relationships. Now, I don't know if it'll work, okay, but it's a suspicion I have that I'm going to try to work with schools teaching young people actually how to do this. You know the classic line, who saw Avatar, the movie Avatar? Okay, who saw it 3D? Okay, good for you, I did too. And I'm embarrassed to admit to this, but one of the people I pay who works with me watched Avatar with her husband, and halfway through the movie leaned over to him and said, "Honey, wouldn't it be great if life was 3D? He just got up, moved a couple of rows, sat down, turned to people going, "I have no idea who she is. She just sat next to me." Okay. You know, the scary thing about Facebook that I also discovered from their book, Born Digital, was this, that 41% of Facebook users are willing to divulge personal information, photos, home address, email, to complete strangers. And only last week in Australia was a tragic story of a teenage girl who thought she was meeting two guys that she'd met on Facebook, met them at a train station, and she's now dead. Not everybody who's going to use Facebook is going to end up dead. But there is some very interesting, scary stuff. Born Digital is an outstanding tool for you as a parent to get and read that you will want to just throw it in front of your teenager randomly and just go, "Just curious, love you to read it," and not tell them, tease them, "Just curious. I'd like to know what you think about what this guy's saying. Look, I'm just a digital immigrant. I don't understand this stuff. So help me out." I put it in front of my teenage daughter and watched her just go, "Oh." There are now companies out there, I employ people, but there are now companies out there that when you're recruiting, you can actually get them and they will give you a report and they have the software that can go online onto Facebook and troll it and find every single article that David Todd has ever written on Facebook if he was applying for the job, or Michael Knight, or Dan Big. Every single thing that you've ever said, that which you've posted and that which you've unposted, because it only comes off your wall, not where it's on other places.
Is that even if you like log out and delete your account?
It's on there. Your photos that are on Facebook are permanently on Facebook.
But if you delete your
account. Even if you delete your account. You've deleted your account no longer is active, but it historically exists. Yeah. And you're posting all that information out there all the time. One of the really scary chapters in Born Digital, which I found very scary as a parent, is as we've got a rise in social networking sites, we have a rise in identity theft. Just the other day, Commonwealth Bank phoned me up. Mr. Knight, yes, this is the Commonwealth Bank. And I wanted to say so badly, yeah, sure it is. Like, when do you ever phone me? But I didn't. I just went, yeah, hello. Well, this is the credit card side of Commonwealth. Yeah, that's nice. Look, we just want to know if you're currently in Bendigo. No. Okay, were you in Ballarat about 3 hours ago? No. Okay, then somebody's using your credit card. We're just going to stop it immediately. There's fraud going on. How the hell did you know that? It was staggering. And somebody had actually created my card. They were going into shops buying stuff with a card with my details on. Somehow, I'd bought something online, and however secure it was, they'd accessed those numbers, recreated a card, and we're now spending stuff. Just the other day, I've got two credit cards. I've had them both updated recently. My credit card statement came in. There was an amount for $47 and $52. My wife, who does the bookkeeping, said, have you got the receipts for these two purchases? And I buy stuff from America a lot, mostly books like Born Digital, to which I went, no, I don't have receipts, but they're not my purchases. I didn't do them. So I phone up the bank, and they said, okay, well, the first one is creditcard.com, which is a internet-based website that you put all your credit card information into, and then it makes all the payments for you to pay off your credit card, and this is a payment off your credit card. And I went, not my credit card, pal. Somebody had got my credit card details and was using my credit card to pay off somebody else's credit card debt. It's like, you can stop that one, but would you pick up $47 on your credit card? I mean, it's not like a $40,000 dent. It's 47 bucks. So one of the things that's very interesting is that young people, on one hand, have got an information, a flood of information. They have this ability to become more savvy, but they are also being more stupid. Now, the book finished, and with this I'm just going to close with a couple of thoughts now. One of the things that they say is beloved Prime Minister's MySpace page, listing his friends. Julia comes up number one. This was before this week's polls. Anyway, I didn't check to see if she's still there. But anyway, apparently. Now, what they say is this. They actually talk about why is there a rise on the social networking sites. And this is worth the price of admission tonight. They actually talk about what they call the disclosure decision model. It works like this. Now, I know David professionally. He has helped me out fix some of my computers. Now, I met him about maybe a year ago. And in that time, we had a number of occasions to be together. During those times we were together, we would have talked. During the conversation, we might have talked about work or home or all sorts of different things. The more we talked about different things, the more we disclosed information about each other, the deeper a friendship started to become. The disclosure decision model works on the principle of information plus time equals friendship. Makes sense, doesn't it? The more you journey with your friends, the more you reveal about yourself, they reveal about them, the deeper the friendship becomes. What a lot of our young people are doing today is they have assumed the bad habit of what social networking sites are doing is they've assumed that the more information they give about themselves, the more friends they will get. And while they are developing what is effectively a very bad habit, they're never actually practicing the healthy skills of good friendships. So there's some dangers there that maybe you need to be aware of that are worth looking at. Two things to close with. First one, this is the Wexner Building in Ohio State University. The insert looks like a castle turret with a bit missing. When you look over here, one of the things you notice is it just looks messy. The building has walls that don't line up. It has pillars that come down and don't touch the floor. And the architect basically claimed that this was America's first postmodern building. postmodern being, it could do whatever it wanted to do. It didn't have to follow the rules. And he wanted to design a building that reflected the trends in current culture, that I don't have to follow the rules, I can do whatever I want. Rabbi Zacharias actually happened to go for a tour through this building. And everywhere through the tour, the guy was just extolling the magnificence of this architecture of postmodern design. And when he got to the end of the tour, the guy dangerously and naively, not knowing who Rabbi was, said, "Are there any questions?" And Rabbi said, "I just have one." He said, "Really? What would you like to know?" He said, "I just have one question for you of the architect." He said, "What's that?" He said, "I just want to know if he followed the same principle with building the foundations." You see, the only reason you can have a column suspended and not touching the floor is somewhere along the line, something's carrying that weight, isn't it? You can mess with the walls, you can mess with the design all you want, but if you mess with the foundations, the building collapses. So, three suggestions to give you some takeaway practices for your parenting tonight. Number one, and these are not psychology, these are my experiences of a parent of an 18-year-old, a 16-year-old and a 14-year-old who, I can say hand on heart, actually do like me. Whether they love me is another issue, but they like me. This is a famed scene from that just magnificent movie, The Castle. If you have not seen The Castle, you have impoverished yourself and you need to do it. And by the way, if you've never been to Melbourne and you've watched the movie The Castle, you need to know there really is a sunshine TAFE. Okay, it's an actual TAFE. And if you drive from the airport out towards the western side of Melbourne, you drive right past Sunshine TAFE. It's a photograph moment. It's fantastic. Now, there's a scene in the movie when they're sitting around the dinner table and they talk about the dinner moment. And at one point they talk about the importance of the dinner moment. And they say, because when they're having dinner, they do something with the TV. What do they do?
Turn it down.
Turn it down. And I sat there and I went, here's tip number one I want to encourage you to try as parents. Have a meal together and turn the flipping TV off. When we moved into our house, I raised it. I used to be a builder, so I raised it and we closed in downstairs. Downstairs is all the living, upstairs is the bedrooms. Downstairs has no TV. We have a dining room. And when we sit down for our dining room meals, our dinner meals, our evening meals, we have music playing, but there is no TVs. When the phone rings, I encourage my children, let it ring. We actually pay for a thing called voicemail. It's okay. And if it's really desperately urgent, it can still wait. Why do I want to wreck my meal knowing that the world has come to an end? Let's finish our meal, then discover the world's come to an end. Why would you waste a perfectly good meal? So I want to encourage us, and I'm amazed at how many families have moved away from this. How many of you saw the movie The Blind Side? Sandra Bullock won Best Female Actress, the Academy Award for it. It's a true story. It is absolutely worth the watch. It is a magnificent, clean movie. It is a great movie. And there's a scene in the movie where they're having Thanksgiving, and Sandra Bullock plays a wonderful Christian mum in a wonderful Christian family. And they're celebrating this magnificent historical American thing called Thanksgiving. And as they go to say grace, before they say grace, the father of the family says, what's the line? Who remembers? Let's be very thankful for our mother who stopped at the shop on the way home to pick up dinner. And it's just so smoothly delivered that nobody gets the gag line, you know, and you're sitting there going, what? So, suggestion number one, have meals together. There is really interesting research now that demonstrates the virtue and the value of eating a meal together as a family and doing something called conversation. It's just great. I decided I'm not a candle man, but I bought a candle. We bought a big fat candle. We whack it in the middle of our table and we light it every night. One of the kids gets to light it because everyone loves playing with fire. So let them light the candle, right? The best thing, we have a fire blanket just behind the wall in case we need it. The best thing is my children are on a rotating roster to help. They have to do the dishes, which is called stacking the dishwasher. But anyway, that's another issue. And that's really a big issue for them, apparently. Anyway, although I did have the moment the other day when my kids went, the dishwasher hasn't washed the dishes. There's no clean dishes. What are we going to do? And I just said to my son, see that thing next to the dishwasher? And he was looking at the sink and he was going, yeah? I said, It's called a sink. And he was just looking at me. And? Like, we've got to watch one, son. And it was literally like, really? It's like a revelation to the boy. But anyway, that's another issue. I want to encourage you to have meals together. Turn your TV off. And develop conversation. Because it's a foundation. And the building collapses if you don't have it. Number two. We live in a technological generation. I bought TiVo recently. How many of anybody here got TiVo? Okay, anybody of you got Foxtel? Okay, there's a magnificent function on both of these. You can watch live TV. What does that little two bars mean? You can pause live TV. Best thing that TiVo basically, it's just a computer that connects to the internet and to your TV. The best thing about TiVo is you can watch anything you want, just record it. But you can pause live TV and then hit play. And then you can skip through the ads. It's fantastic. You can watch MasterChef in 40 minutes. It's great. You don't have to go, oh, wait, oh, no. You know, it's just fantastic. I want to encourage you, do not become slaves to the TV program. Hit the pause button. We made a practice in our family that we have one night of the week, which is no TV night. I love that. My kids, first of all, went, what are we going to do? I don't know, maybe we could talk. We bought board games out. We started playing Monopoly. Then one of my kids said, oh, you can get us an app on your iPhone, Dad. It's like... they missed the tactileness of going, dum, 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 dum. Oh! Anyway, it's a... And then number three, this is really important. Not watch Spicks and Specks or buy Spicks and Specks as a product. How many of you watch that show, know anything about it? Okay. Basically, it's a really interesting music quiz show. But it's really good because it often talks about stuff that was written before Justin Bieber came on the scene. And I'm just thankful for that, right? Okay. I don't mind if you like watching little boys sing music, but I rather watch men sing music. I like Bono and people like that, or even Frank Sinatra. But anyway, what's really interesting is this. Most of us in our day-to-day world, and I'm meaning our 9-to-5 world, have a work face. And in that time, if your workplace is not too bad, you will often find the ability to laugh, joke, interact, and interplay. But then we get home, and we just suddenly, and we're all just too tired. And one of the things that I reckon, one of the key foundations of keeping your family alive, is keep a sense of humour. Keep the humour going in your family. One of the great moments for me came when my 18-year-old, who at the time was not 18, she was about 16, she said to me one night, you know, Dad, when you do discipline us, which is not very often, and not in terms of a smack, but like, no, you can't go out, or no, you can't do whatever it is. She said, whenever you call us out, she said, you're really stern, and you're really authoritative, but there's always a smile that comes on your face, and I know I'm loved. And I kind of had this moment where I went, oh, I forgive you, but I was smart enough to not say that. So I was like, because you just don't want to give away everything straight away. But my encouragement to you is learn to keep laughter in your house, because you can laugh at work, you can laugh at play, keep laughter back in the home. Make laughter the most dominant tone in your house. Because so often by the time we get home, we're so tired that most of the tone is, stop that, put that away. Have you cleaned your room? Why isn't this organized? What are you doing? No, you can't watch this. Come on, sit down, hurry up. We've got to get dinner on. We've got to get this. We've got to do this. We've got to, come on, what's going on? No! And we lose it, don't we? And I want to encourage us, hit the damn pause button on the TV, turn the thing off sometimes when you're having dinner, and laugh. Because there's something about that that just brings families back together. I'm intrigued. I told you at the beginning we have international students living with us, only ever one at a time. The current one we've got is from Hong Kong. Our experience of most of the people we've ever had from Asia tends to be that they're very reclusive and they like to just stay in their room and never engage. We've therefore generally tended to have people from Europe, and we've had fantastic times. But this was an emergency situation, and we got this girl from Hong Kong, and we thought, whatever, it was only a short-term thing anyway. The first 3 days she lived with us, she barely emerged out of her room. But by day four, I noticed she stayed in the lounge room after dinner. Day five, she would hang around the dinner table after we were finished eating, because we never rush away from, because I made a point of buying comfortable dining room chairs because I want you to talk. And it dawned on me, we're about 3 weeks in now. She's about with us 3 weeks now. And I've noticed something. We got an email from her mum the other day from Hong Kong who said, I just can't tell you how much I'm so thankful that you have taken my daughter in and that you're looking after her. She's constantly telling me how she loves coming home to your place because of the good food and because of the laughter and because of the fact you as a family talk. And I thought, I had no idea we were impacting this girl that way. I had no idea at all. And we're not special. We get it wrong. Ask my wife. She will tell you I get it wrong all the time. And to which she then claims she never does, but I say, but you married me. And if I get it wrong all the time, then by anyway, you got the idea. So I'm coming to your marital course later on because I need help. So listen, thank you very, very much. I hope that's been some encouragement to you. But my three tips, you know, turn your TV off when you have dinner together, and talk. Hit the pause button on the TV, and then keep laughter in your house. Thank you very much. Tim. I think part of it is because teenagers during that adolescent window, they're now testing out your values. So the reason they don't want to be with you anymore is because they are intentionally trying to move away. There's an interesting biblical proverb that says, raise a child up in the ways of the Lord and he will not depart from it. It's interesting that most parents naively read that thinking, if I raise my child up in biblical frameworks, they will never become the prodigal and go off on the tangent. That is not what the Hebrew passage means at all. It literally means if you instill in the child, and by the way, I read a research paper the other day that said by the age of 6 months, babies have developed a very clear sense of right and wrong. By 6 months, they're not talking yet. They've already implicitly developed it. If you raise the child up in the ways of the Lord, he will not depart from it. Literally means that which you've embedded into the child is like a pit bull and it will never leave the child. So it's not the child will never leave the church or the child will never leave the home. It's those values that you put into the child will stay with the child wherever they go. Because there was a moment for the prodigal when he said, even my father's servants live better than this. I'm better off going back home. And I could just be one of the servants and it would be better than what I'm doing right now because it will never depart from him. So, yes, the peers are always going to be different and that's part of the challenge and part of the joy of parenting is that they are going to break away and that's the goal. But if you've instilled, then it never departs from them. And that's the challenge. And Celia's book, He'll Be Okay, If You Have Boys, talks about the need to cut the apron string. And I believe we've got an increasing generation of mothers who will not let their boys go and we have desperately got to teach mums, you've got to cut the apron string. You've got to do it. I love my wife passionately. I've told her from the day my son was born, when he turns 13, he's your youngest, he's your baby, he's your little boy, he's your cutie, he's your whatever you're going to call him. But when he's 13, he's a young man. And my wife just looked at me and I stood her down on that point. I said, we'll negotiate on everything else. But this one, you've got to learn to let the boy go. And that's really hard for mums. But you know what the worst case scenario is? There was a 35-year-old man who was busted for doing drug taking at an elite sports level. You might have heard of him. He has blonde hair, used to play cricket, does spin bowling apparently. And when he was found guilty for taking illegal substances, do you know what his defence was? My mum gave it to me. Do you know what his mum... He was in South Africa at the time. That was what he declared as his defence. From the other side of the world, his mother went on national TV and said, I gave it to him. At 35. There's just a little bit of codependency issue there going on, I think. So, you know what? Mums have got to learn to cut the apron strings. So, instill early... It will not depart from them. Yes, it's challenging. It's part of the journey of parenting. You've got to let them go. Because at some point, your parents let you go. It's a great question. Yeah, how do you let him go? I really would encourage you, if you've got a boy, get the book, He'll Be Okay, and read it. There's some very good practical tips in there that will answer some of that stuff. Secondly, I think it's in incremental ways. And it's also contextual, depending on the circumstances and the situation, learning how to do it. If there is a man in the house, then part of it is actually letting him take over a significant role. One of the things Celia says, I think it's a brilliant idea, when your boy turns 13 and goes to high school, that the mother should take her phone number off the emergency contact list and just give the husband's mobile number. Well, you know what? And you know what? I'm so glad you said that. Are you the... You know, thank you. Do you know what? Celia actually says in the book, one of the issues, because she's a mother, she can say this. The issue that the mothers get is you permanently catastrophize. The boy will be dead if we put dad in charge. And dad's response is, he'll bleed, but he won't die. There it is. Yeah, and you know what? He won't die. I'm standing in my church the other day with a mother and three boys. They're all running around and going crazy. She, the whole time was talking to me, was constantly doing this. And I turned around. I never moved once. And at one point I laughed at her and I said, it's just so funny watching you. And she said, oh, and I said, Natalie, I'm watching the boy, I'm telling you. It's like, if something comes, I'll grab him before he hits that car. But up until that stage, let him run around. Now, appropriate boundaries, absolutely. But you've got to learn to let him go. You've got to learn to let him go. Because you don't want to be 35 going, yeah, it's my excuse. And there's an increasing rise now of mothers who are phoning up to schools lying for their children. Classic one Celia talks about was a boy got busted for drinking. He was in the principal's office. Alcohol was in, you know, the principal had the bottle of alcohol. Phones mum, your son's been caught drinking. We've got to deal with it. She says, can't possibly be my son. He's with me right now. Principal said, unless he's morphed or you've done some cloning, he's standing in my office. I know of a school where a boy was caught dealing drugs. His dad was a lawyer. The boy was caught red-handed dealing. Charges were laid, as they would have to do under the Education and Legal Act. The dad sued the school for planting the drugs on the boy. I don't know what happened in the end. I think the school actually won. But parents are lying for their boys. And you know what? We've got to teach them. We've got to say to them, you know what? You've got to take responsibility. So, mums, the kid won't die. Okay? And let the dad take responsibility. And if he does die, then take it out on your husband. You know? Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
You can't just say, oh, you're
13. No, no. Yeah, I'm not saying that. Yeah, absolutely. That's what I'm saying. Incremental stages. Yeah. Celia uses the metaphor, the bridge of adolescence. You've got to let the boy walk across the bridge of adolescence. And what the mum has to do is stop at this end and let dad take the boy across the bridge of adolescence. And one of the dads says, that'll never work. And she said, why not? She said, because she won't let him go. And then another guy said, no, my wife's going to be the troll under the bridge. You know, but you know what? And yelling instructions all the way. But the answer is, let the dads take some responsibility. Let them do it. I'm loving parenting my teenage son. I absolutely love it. We get boundaries. We get it all the time. We do stuff all the time. He got busted on the internet for seeing something he shouldn't have been seeing. I banned him for a month just straight away. Just for a month. You know, no questions asked. My daughter is extremely manipulative. She draws out of my end of the gene pool. And she plays my wife like a 2-cent piece. And she just won't do it with me because I'm just like, no. I look at my daughter and she just knows. Today she had a student free day, so she stayed at home. And I just said to her straight up, I said, here's the deal. No screen time at all until normal time about 4:30 this afternoon. I came in at one point, she was actually just about to go on the computer. I said, what are you doing? She said, I'm just going to... I said, is that a screen? And then she just stopped and walked away. Now, Mum had been there. She would have tried to manipulate and argue around it. I'm home. I'm bored. It's okay, honey. Get a thing called a book. It uses imaginary pictures. So, yeah, so you got to, it's incremental. It's not cataclysmic. Question? Yes. There's a significant number of absent males. But your 2 points. First one that's really interesting is parents need to talk to each other. My neighbour across the street, the three dads are the same age. We have three 13-year-old boys. And they just hive together all the time. We thought we were the best parents in the world. I have a rule of 20 minutes screen time, then you've got to get off. Because I have three kids, one computer, that works out to one go every hour, basically. And I was managing this brilliantly. Mitch and the two guys would come over, they'd be on the computer for 20 minutes. We have an egg timer, when it rings, get off. And they would. And they would go out and play. And I was going, fantastic. Wouldn't see them for about an hour. And then one day, the three of us were talking one day, and the parents were talking, and we went, what are the boys doing in your place? Oh, they're on the computer for 20 minutes, then I kick them off. What are they doing in your place? They're on the computer for 20 minutes, then I kick them off. And then the two dads looked at me, and they went, 20 minutes? And I went, so now it's 20 minutes off the computer at anyone's house. You know, and now, of course, they go play touch rugby on our front verge with no streetlights at night because I reckon it's more fun to play in the dark. And I think that's a great idea, you know, because they won't kill themselves. They might bleed a bit, but they're not going to kill themselves. So that's a really good point. So, but parents, talk. If my son's saying he's going for a sleepover, I want to speak to your parent.
That's it. I agree with that.
Is my son's coming to your place? Is that right? Yes. Is there alcohol going to be there? Will there be anybody there that you know that might potentially have to? I want to know. Because it's my child coming to your place. I want to talk. Are you going to be there the whole time? Are you never going to leave the presence of these kids? I want to know. Because if it's not, no, you can't go. It's just the way it's going to be. I'd rather deal with my kid hating me than my kid dead. So that's a critical point. Your second point, though, about fatherlessness, I think is a really critical thing. Children intuitively will find a substitute male. So if dad's not at home, the boy will find a man in his world. Could be a male teacher, could be a sporting coach, it could be someone. And oftentimes, and I've seen this from so many different people, the man may never know that he is that influence on the boy. But the boy will look at him and have decided, you're the man I want to try to work out how to be like. You know, more times than not, no, it's actually the positive. I mean, certainly there is obviously going to be occasions where it's not, but far more than not, it's going to be the good one. Not enough. Ask the question all the time. Who's going? What are they doing? Where is it? And I think one of the things, parenting is a thing of seasons. And one of the final seasons, the way it ends up, the way it should end up, the way I think the ideal, is that your children become your friends as adults. But when they're children, they're not your friends. They're your children. You will do as I say. When they're teenagers, you're the coach. Now, it's my recommendation that you don't run into the wall. But if you do, it's going to win and you're going to hurt. So clear consequences, clear boundaries, clear recommendations. But you know what? Some of you are going to have to see if that element's hot. Okay. I mean, I really prefer you don't do it, but, you know, so there's that difference. Say, but when they're little kids, I'm holding your hand because we're walking across a road because you haven't got a clue. And I'm not going to let you go. Now it's, we got to walk across the road. You know how to do this, but you also understand the consequences. And when it's at this end, it's nice that they say to you, I'm going to walk across the road. It's a good idea. And that's the challenge of parenting, is to never lose sight of the seasonal shifts that go on. And that's a hard one, because our kids are staying home longer. But they're staying home as adults. And you know what? I don't think it ever gets easy like that. My daughter, who's 18, I'm a light sleeper. I know when she comes home. And I won't go into any deep sleep until I hear the door shut. I love her. Of course I do. It never changes. But she is the adult. One, your relationship with your daughter is going to be critical, so whatever the current state of that is going to determine how you actually end up managing that. So the more you invest into that, and the more relational that is, the more easy it would be to manage. The more authoritarian you are, the more difficult that's going to become. So it's whatever that balance is, you've got to work that through. I personally couldn't imagine why a 12-year-old needs a Facebook account. more than happy for the kid to pick up the phone and phone their friend. I'm more than happy to take my kid around to a friend's house if they want to play. I'm more than happy for a kid to come around to my place and play with my daughter. It's an old-fashioned concept. It's called friendship and playing, but you know, I think it'll come back. So at a 12-year-old level like that, maybe the next level up is you do it with if you're going to do it, put very clear boundaries in and monitoring. Put filters on, put also the right to view so that you can monitor whatever they're doing. And I'm sure there's a way you can set that up. So I would do it at that level like that. But I think that's one of the challenges. We just decided our kids wouldn't get mobile phones until they were 18. And my 16-year-old is going, everybody at school has got a mobile phone. To which I say, that's not true. You don't. But you know something? The argument died down. She doesn't care now. She really doesn't care. We have a spare one, just on a prepaid. So if they ever go out, they take that phone with them so they can phone me. But they never do. And it's not on. So I don't know why I bought it. It was a waste of time. But, again, it's making clear what your expectations are as a parent. We just said, no, we're not going to do that. That was just our decision. If you don't like it, we'll go pick another family. So,
thanks, Michael.
Thank you. Thank you.